There was a clever and biting piece of satire yesterday from Andy Borowitz at NewYorker.com. He writes, calling the Republican nominee's behavior completely indefensible, the Russian President Vladimir Putin canceled a joint campaign appearance with Donald Trump on Monday. Putin had been scheduled to campaign alongside Trump at a rally in Columbus, Ohio. Ouch and touche. It's Current State here on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thank you for joining us today. In last week's environmental segment, we heard from a member of a Michigan Anglers Association. Tom Baird and others are concerned with a tiny invasive snail recently discovered in the Au Sable River near Grayling. Mr. Baird was critical of the Michigan Department of Natural Resources and raised doubts about the Grayling hatchery and its possible role in spreading the New Zealand mud snail. That same day, DNR announced that the Grayling hatchery had been recently inspected and had taken other measures in an effort to stop the spread of the snail. To learn more, we welcome Michigan DNR Executive Director Keith Cray. Keith Cray, thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Mark. Good to be here.
Before we get into some of Mr. Baird's criticism of the agency on this snail issue, let's review the most recent actions DNR has taken. The press release from a week ago says that three Michigan agencies did inspect the Grayling fish hatchery the week before last, that's the week of September 26th. For the record, what did you learn from that inspection?
Yeah, thanks, Mark, and I appreciate the opportunity. So let's just step back just a little bit. So as you know, New Zealand mud snails were confirmed in the Au Sable River, and based upon that finding, it was found downstream from the hatchery. So immediately, the agencies, and it was a joint agencies between the Department of Environmental Quality, Department of Natural Resources, and the Department of Ag and Rural Development, we actually visited with the hatchery owner, and we assumed that since it's a flow-through system that the hatchery could be infested. So we asked the hatchery owner to implement practices and put those in place immediately to help mitigate any movement potential from that. And then very specifically to the inspection we conducted, it was once again conducted by all three agencies because the hatchery is actually, it's licensed by the Department of Ag and Rural Development as an aquaculture facility. It's permitted under the Department of Environmental Quality through the MPDES permit relative to effluent standards. And then DNR actually permits any of the movement of fish into public waters. So that's the reason why all three agencies went. There was a small number of New Zealand mud snails found on the walls of a raceway in the facility. But a couple things that your listeners may want to be aware of. One is we did sacrifice, if you will, inspect a number of fish. There were no New Zealand mud snails found in the in those fish. The operator also uses well water in any transportation of fish. And there's some other mitigation measures, such as requiring that fish are moved relatively short period of time after feeding, so that they're not foraging on any of the other areas within the raceway.
So you did find a small number of specimens presumed to be New Zealand mud snails. They're, again, as you say, they were collected from the walls of the hatchery's raceways. How worrisome is that? How big a deal is that?
Well, that in and of itself is not as worrisome as just New Zealand mud snails in general. As you know, it's been confirmed in a couple different rivers, the Pierre Marquette and the Boardman, and now the Au Sable. We're doing some comprehensive surveying around the state to see what the establishment of those may be, and that is a concern in and of itself. So we actually appreciate the anglers of the Au Sable having passion around the issue to help identify the issue and then help reduce any potential to spread that around the state.
Tom Baird told our listeners last week that the DNR and the DEQ failed to act when his group first requested an inspection of the Grayling fish hatchery. Let's listen to how he put that last week, and then you can respond. Here he is.
So we asked the DNR and the DEQ to immediately inspect the fish hatchery to see whether it was the source of the mud snails and also to determine whether while the infestation was localized, whether there could be some fix or cure to the problem. The DNR and the DEQ just refused to go into the hatchery. They said the owner wouldn't allow them in, and they declined to get a warrant to go in and take a look. Since then, the mud snail has spread both upstream and downstream and into the mainstream of the Sable.
So Mr. Baird says his group discovered the snail downstream from the fish hatchery in early June and informed the DNR about the snail shortly thereafter. DNR finally inspected the hatchery the week of September 26th. Should it have been inspected sooner?
Yeah, so I would take issue with Mr. Baird's comment that it spread from the hatchery upstream and downstream. I'm not aware of any fact that he could base that statement on, just for clarity. And so we did immediately act, and the way we immediately act was is we spoke with and got confirmation from the hatchery owner that they would not move fish without mitigation measures in place. And so... So that's one. Two is there's certainly the conversation around how quickly do you get into the facility. So the three agencies met. They came up with protocols. They worked with the owner, and it really was not as much of a as Mr. Baird characterizes a refusal for entry, because over time, one of the agencies certainly would have that regulatory authority. But we acted with the urgency of we assume the facility was infested, and we had those measures put in place.
Well, but still, hindsight being 2020, should the hatchery have been inspected earlier?
Certainly the hatchery could have been inspected earlier, to your point. But the question is what safeguards are in place regardless of if it was inspected or not. The same mitigation measures are put into place. The fish were not being moved and generally stocked into public waters. It's primarily going for for food, and so that's the primary intent and purpose.
Mr. Baird suggests you could have gotten a warrant to inspect the fish farm earlier. Can you talk to us about that? I mean, could you have done that?
Well, I think the appropriate answer is under one of the three agencies probably could have went and sought a court order and sought a warrant to get access into that property. The DNR's authority primarily is in permitting for movement. The DEQ's is primarily for affluence, and MDARD's, the Michigan Department of Ag and Rural Development, is primarily for raising of fish. So it's not quite as straightforward as what Mr. Baird paints, and that's why it is as quick to work with the operator to get practices in place to help mitigate those issues.
In a letter that you wrote to Tom Baird, dated 2 weeks ago today, you referred to, and I'll quote here, the absence of a confirmed positive sighting in rearing units at the hatchery, unquote. Mr. Baird said he was baffled by this because he said no inspection had taken place by that date. So the chronology here is kind of important. Had an inspection been taken place at the hatchery at that point?
No, it hadn't, and it said in the and that's where I would encourage the entire reading of that sentence. So you read the first clause, and the whole clause says, in the absence of a confirmed at that site, we put practices into place as if it was infested. It doesn't say that we did nothing, that in the absence of that confirmation. What it says, in the absence of a confirmation, we put practices in place. And so I think it's fair to read the whole sentence, not just the first clause.
We're talking with Mr. Keith Cray, director of Michigan's Department of Natural Resources, about the New Zealand mud snail and criticism of the agency we heard last week for doing too little here. Do more measures need to be taken to prevent the spread of this snail? Talk to us about the future here, the future effort.
Yeah, well, we all play a role in that, and all the citizens of Michigan will play a role in that. There certainly is the potential for transport through aquaculture. We recognize that, and we need to make sure that mitigation measures are in place. We need to make sure that primarily that goes for a food source, and we need to look at any individual permit to assure that we're not spreading New Zealand mud snail around. However, in addition to that, the public can help. There is a need to do a education and awareness campaign relative to the ability to move them on waders, on kayaks, on paddles, on normal recreation activities. And so it has been found in other water bodies. Aquaculture is not in those water bodies. There is something else that is happening relative to vectoring, and so we all need to play our part in reducing that that risk.
You referred to the flow-through system at the grayling hatchery, and I know this is a bone of contention here in this topic here. There are flow-through systems, and there are recirculating systems. Tom Baird and his allies would argue that flow-through systems are inherently more dangerous than recirculating because they connect to the stream. I mean, the stream flows into the hatchery, and then whatever happens at the hatchery flows out again back into the Aussable. Talk to us about your concern, or if you have concerns, about these flow-through systems and whether or not they ought to be curtailed or more closely monitored or whatever.
Yes, Mark, and you say, well, so the anglers of the Aussable, they are in litigation, and they are taking issue with the permit that's been issued to the grayling hatchery. The hatchery has been around for a long period of time, as many of your listeners know, and has been run by the county, by the state, and now by a private individual. So I put it in that context. I absolutely agree with you that the best aquaculture systems are those that are recirculating, or they'll call them closed systems, and that has less of a risk factor. There are a number of open systems in this state. It's not unique to this state. And so in those systems where it is diverting some water out of a stream, there does need to be appropriate regulatory oversight. They do need to meet effluent standards, and they need to make sure that they are not degrading the water resource.
Mr. Baird and others as well, I take it, are also critical of permission for the hatchery owner to expand that operation many times over. Now, given that a small number of specimens presumed to be New Zealand mud snails were discovered there, is the expansion of that hatchery a concern for DNR?
Well, the expansion of the hatchery is actually something that is being reviewed by all the agencies. And so if you, for instance, in the MPDS permit, it talks about in order to increase production, you have to meet the permit standards, and that's what's being argued and reviewed on the legal aspect of things. So I think that everyone shares the concern that any operation needs to have the management and regulatory standards in place so that there's not degradation of the resource.
So there is a possibility then that expansion permit may be revoked.
Well, it's not that it's revoked. It's in that permit, it says you cannot expand until there's satisfaction of the regulatory agencies that you're meeting your permit standards.
We want to thank Mr. Keith Cray, Director of Michigan's Department of Natural Resources. We've been discussing the New Zealand mud snail and criticism of DNR that we heard last week for doing too little to respond to it. Keith Cray, thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
Coming up on Current State, New Jersey Democrat Cory Booker turned a lot of heads during his tenure as the mayor of Newark, New Jersey. His popularity helped propel him into the U.S. Senate in 2013. At the party convention last August in Philadelphia, Booker told his fellow Democrats they were all in this together.
Because I believe this election is a referendum on who best embodies the leadership we need to go far together. Donald Trump is not that leader.
This week, Cory Booker is in Michigan. In fact, he's appearing in East Lansing today, stumping for Hillary Clinton. We'll talk with the New Jersey senator about being a surrogate on the campaign trail. That's coming up. An MSU art history professor has spent several years learning about notable architecture in East Lansing from the middle of the 20th century. Now, Susan Bandy's work has become a coffee table book from the MSU Press. Scott Pohl talked with her about the project. What's the book called, Scott?
Mark, it's called Mid-Michigan Modern, From Frank Lloyd Wright to Googie. This project started in 2012 during the planning stages of an exhibition at Cranbrook. Later, she had students help with researching local architecture from this period in East Lansing, and she curated an exhibit at the MSU Museum. Now comes this book. On October 22nd, there will be a tour of some beautiful homes in Okemos, and we'll have a link for more information at WKAR.org. Susan Bandies tells me that she has included Lansing and Okemos in the project so she could include nearby Frank Lloyd Wright designs.
So we already knew about the Usonian project, that was seven houses, but the other houses I kind of rediscovered. And there are some wonderful stories, and the archives at Taliesin are full of letters back and forth, and then at a certain point they just stop. So I could track down a daughter of one of the families to find out that why it
they
wasn't
didn't build
built.
It? Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that Wright had designed a three-bedroom house, and she came along. So the house was too small because they had two sons and the parents' bedroom. Plus, there were some issues about the ceiling height not being high enough, you know, the typical back and forth
Frank Lloyd Wright things.
Yeah. So that family didn't build their house, but a couple years later, they actually took their drawings to a local architect who built a very close copy of it.
One of the other locally prominent architects that is covered in the book is Kenneth Black.
Kenneth Black went into his father's firm. It was Lee and Kenneth Black, and his father was prominent beginning of the 20th century. And then when his father died, it became the Kenneth Black firm. He was very high up in the American Institute of Architects. There's an article I found in the New York Times quoting him. So he was quite well known during his day. And he did buildings like Lansing City Hall. He did the Lansing Public Library. He did schools. He was very active in the Michigan architecture community. I found some wonderful articles that he did for the Lansing State Journal talking about why somebody should build a modernist house, not a colonial, you know, like past eras.
You mentioned he'd done some writing for the State Journal. Is that what you wanted to refer to in a reading from your book for us?
Yes, I would. This is an article that Kenneth Black wrote in the January 1st, 1951 issue of the Lansing State Journal. He says, "I'm only going to live once, and I don't want to live my one life in an imitation of a colonial house, surrounded by imitations of antique furniture and other gadgets reminiscent of days that are long dead and gone. I want to live today's life today. I want my house and my office and my furniture to be as different from my grandfather as my car is different from his horse and buggy. Then I will feel that I am really living a contemporary life instead of simply existing in an atmosphere of phony antiquity."
The words of Kenneth Black. Now, you also write about Keck and Keck, and they're even less familiar to me than the name Kenneth Black had been.
Keck and Keck were two brothers. Their architecture firm was based in Chicago. And if you go into the northern suburbs of Chicago, Evanston, for example, there are a lot of Keck and Keck houses. They came to prominence in the Century of Progress World's Fair in Chicago in 1933. They did a model home that was all glass and none of the windows opened. So they became very well known for innovative ventilation systems. And what I found in working in the Keck and Keck papers, which are in Wisconsin, there's one house that was actually built and another house that was designed but never built. So the house that was built is right alongside the second oldest Frank Lloyd Wright house, and it too will be open on that October 22nd day. There's only one window in the entire house that opens. But as you look at the windows, you realize there's a very sophisticated louver system. So there are ways to get ventilation, air circulating around. And the couple who built that house, the Panchins, were in the original Frank Lloyd Wright project. He was a professor of forestry, and he had some arguments back and forth with Wright about the wood that he was proposing to use that Panchen didn't think would last well. So they dropped their Frank Lloyd Wright house, and they went to Keck and Keck, having seen the house, or the model house at the Century of Progress. And Lucy, the wife, was the correspondent with Keck and Keck. And she would often say that Frank Lloyd Wright wasn't responding to Mr. Bronner, but that her work with the Keck and Kecks was so easy. And come see for yourself, you know, their house is not coming along, our house is beautiful. And so a lot of this sort of jealousy. But right in that cul-de-sac in Okemos, there's the Panchen house. To the west is the Bronner Frank Lloyd Wright house. Just on the other side of the road is the third Frank Lloyd Wright house. So it's a wonderful little corner of architecture in our community.
Susan Bandes is a professor of art history at MSU. Her new book on notable Lansing area architecture from about 1940 to 1970 is called Mid-Michigan Modern, From Frank Lloyd Wright to Googie. And here's where I ask you to tell us about Googie and cite local examples.
Googie architecture takes its name from roadside attractions in Los Angeles. There was actually a diner or drive-in that was called the Googie Diner. And it's the term that is given to very prosaic buildings, buildings that you would pass by in a car. So they had to be flashy. They had to really catch your eye. So a lot of the zigzags and boomerang forms are Googie forms. In our area, a very good example is Bell's Pizza, which used to be Dawn Donuts. And every Dawn Donuts in Michigan looked exactly the same. And there used to be one, I hear, in almost every little town. Another example is the Big B's that's on Grand River, kind of the western edge of East Lansing. That was originally an Arby's. I think it was the fifth or sixth Arby's franchise in the country. And Arby's designed an architecture that looks like a Conestoga wagon. And the original sign on the road was a 10-gallon hat. So again, you'd sort of recognize these. You had a certain level of comfort because you knew what you would find inside.
I wanted to ask you about the way the book looks. It's a large format book, and it includes lots of beautiful drawings as well as photography.
I hired a local photographer, Kim Kaufman, who did a lot of the photography for me, and her images are great. The State Historic Preservation Office also had some images that I was able to borrow. Some of the plans or drawings for houses that weren't built, I got from the Dow Archives, from Taliesin, the Frank Lloyd Wright Archives, from Harvard, the Stubbins Papers. He was the architect of Lantern Hill. Because I've been in the area for a long time, I actually knew a lot of the people who lived in these houses, and people were very willing to lend me blueprints, which I had digitized, and some people lent me photographs that they had, especially if a house was so substantially changed that I really wanted to show it in its 1950s look.
Tell me about the exhibit related to the book at the Michigan History Museum.
Currently, there is an exhibit at the Michigan History Museum that's a collaboration between the State Historic Preservation Office. Their part is about Michigan Modern. The Archives of Michigan, which received some papers by William Kessler, who's the architect of their building, also a Detroit architect, and they have some of his artwork on view. And then my section is Mid-Michigan Modern Residences. So there are three parts to the exhibition. It will stay on view through April 7th in 2017. And there'll be lots of programming related to it.
Susan Bandes directed MSU's Kresge Art Museum from 1986 to 2010. She's a professor of art history at MSU, and she's written a beautiful book from the MSU Press called Mid-Michigan Modern, From Frank Lloyd Wright to Googie. Susan Bandes, thank you.
You're welcome.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
And coming up on Current State, the Happen Dance School in Lansing has a newly named director. Meet Heather Vaughn Southard and find out what challenges she anticipates tackling the Mid-Michigan Dance Troupe in the years ahead. That's coming up on Current State. WKAR's Fall Donor Campaign is just a few days away. We've got some giveaways for the Fall Campaign. This week, when you visit WKAR.org and you make your contribution, you'll be entered to win a one-night stay and play courtesy of Firekeepers Casino in Battle Creek. Visit WKAR.org to get on board, and we thank you for your support. 4 weeks, that's how long until what's arguably been the most contentious presidential election season in American history will be decided. Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump have less than 30 days to rally their bases and sway undecided voters into their ranks. Michigan is a key battleground for both campaigns. Yesterday, Hillary Clinton visited Detroit, and one of her most popular surrogates is also touring the state this week. New Jersey Senator Cory Booker was in Ypsilanti last night for a voter registration rally. Today, he's visiting Michigan State University here in East Lansing for the same purpose. Mr. Booker served 7 years as the mayor of Newark, New Jersey, before being elected to the U.S. Senate in 2013. He joins us now by phone. Senator Booker, welcome to Michigan. Welcome to Current State.
It is so great to be back to Michigan. Thank you for having me on. And this is my ancestral home. My grandfather worked in the Willow Run bomber plant there in Ypsilanti, and my mom in Detroit. So it's just good to be back in this great state.
So you went east, young man. Is that it?
I did, exactly.
You're traveling in Michigan with two of your Democratic colleagues, our own senators, Debbie Stabenow and Gary Peters. You were at Eastern Michigan University last night for a Get Out the Vote event. How were you received? How do you describe the Democrats that you're talking to?
Well, I tell you, I got such a reception, I almost felt like I was a home state senator. And if it wasn't for the fact that you guys have two amazing ones, or it's two of my close friends and mentors in the Senate, I might have asked them if I could stay a little longer. It's such a special community, and the enthusiasm for Secretary Clinton and Tim Kaine is beyond what I thought it was. I didn't expect to find a packed room rally with so many people so enthusiastic. And then we went to a University of Michigan late night. And had a full room of folks until past 11, almost midnight, talking about the issue. So it's been an incredible start so far to the day.
I don't mean to take any focus all off of Hillary's efforts here in Michigan, but so much of the news these days is generated from the Trump campaign, and I want to ask you about something that broke yesterday involving him. House Speaker Paul Ryan, who had been reluctant to endorse Donald Trump, now says he'll no longer defend him, and that he'll focus his attention on preserving the GOP's seats in the House. We've never seen this type of statement from a U.S. House Speaker before. How do you interpret that?
Well, I don't think it's anything new, and people need to remember that before this moment, Paul Ryan, when Donald Trump insulted and really demeaned and degraded a U.S. federal judge who happened, born in Indiana, that happened to have Mexican parents, And Paul Ryan was surprised me. He stood up and said that is textbook racism. And so here is Paul Ryan and many other Republicans who had to constantly try to explain or defend or get voters to look beyond these constant demeaning and degrading statements. I think I think a lot of folks are now saying I've had all I can stand and I can't stand anymore. And I have great colleagues in the Senate on both sides of the aisle, and I went to Washington not to be a New Jersey's Democratic senator, but to be all of New Jersey's senator. So I made a point to develop for friendships and relationships across the aisle. And when my friends like Ben Sasse or Jeff Flake just find it really deplorable what Donald Trump is saying and meaning and degrading and have turned away from him, There's never been a candidate in any either party in my lifetime that has had such defections from them, not based on policy, not based on issues, but based on fitness and character. And I think it should say something to the electorate.
We do want to clarify, Ryan did not withdraw his endorsement of Trump. He just basically is saying he's on his own now. Another newsworthy item that doesn't affect Donald Trump directly. Yesterday, the Trump Taj Mahal Casino in Atlantic City, in your home state, closed its doors. It was recently operated by Carl Icahn, not Donald Trump. Still, the Trump name is associated with it, and about 3,000 jobs have been lost there in your state. How big an impact does this have in New Jersey?
It is a brutal impact, and please understand, this casino, you're correct, was being run by Carl Icahn. It was Carl Icahn's decision, not Donald Trump's. But we who are in New Jersey remember when Donald Trump did run casinos there and left a wake of economic devastation behind him, not paying contractors, stiffing small businesses, and eventually running his one casino into the ground while others around him thrive, and then walking out and claiming, Atlantic City was good to me. I brought out millions of dollars from Atlantic City. Well, he may have gotten rich, but he hurt other people. And that's the unfortunate thing. People aren't understanding how his business success happened. I mean, he became a wealthy man by hurting Americans. In fact, at times, with all of his products, from his ties to his suits, they're made in other countries. He's not even making them here, which is a choice business people can make. And there are lots of American manufacturers who could have done his products, could have created American jobs. So here's somebody who's trying to create this aura of a great business person. But if you look at his business practices, they've left a lot of pain, a lot of hurt around places. In Atlantic City, Republicans and Democrats, we have a Republican mayor in Atlantic City. People have very bitter feelings towards Donald Trump.
We're talking with Democratic U.S. Senator Cory Booker of New Jersey. He's been in Michigan since yesterday, stumping for Hillary Clinton. And today he's attending a voter registration rally at the Student Union here at Michigan State University. Many Americans have said they do not trust Hillary Clinton, especially after the email and server controversies. How have you personally come to terms with those destructive allegations against your candidate?
Well, for me, it's not been hard in the sense that I know she made mistakes and she owned up to them. I know that she's been investigated by Congress in ways that no other person did. We had more investigations over the emails in Benghazi than there were under the 9/11 attacks and the like. She's been investigated by Congress, multiple hearings, millions and millions of dollars led by Republicans. She's been investigated by the FBI. No criminal charges have been filed. That's why it's so destructive the way that the Trump campaign is characterizing her. I heard in the debate that Donald Trump said, if I was president, you'd be in jail. Well, that's what third world dictators do to their political enemies, their judge, jury, and executioner. We have process in this country, and Hillary Clinton, trust me, she has been through the ringer on both of these things, more so than others, and she's come out with no criminal charges, no ethics charges. And so she made a mistake. She owned up to it. But that does not in any way, and we all have made them, take away from the totality of her career, her preparation, her training. When I'm in the Senate and I have senior Senate Republicans telling me that when she was a senator, she was one of those people that worked across the aisle, did bipartisan bills, got things passed. When she was Secretary of State, you had people like John McCain praising her as a Secretary of State before she declared that she was running for president. So here's somebody who has a record of working across the aisle, bringing people together, and actually getting things done. So I know that none of us have spotless careers. I have made mistakes, public mistakes, things I regret. But the reality is, we are all mountain ranges. We have peaks and valleys. Secretary Clinton is a beautiful mountain range of many peaks of a success. She's prepared and qualified and ready to be president of the United States.
What are you saying to former Sanders supporters who are still kind of might be hurting over their what happened to their guy?
Well, I just say if you're a person that believes in social justice, if you're a person that is striving to defend and fight for the marginalized in this country, I spent my entire career up until the last 3 years in the Senate working full-time in an American inner city, fighting for rights and justice and equality. If you care about these issues, don't fall into the full sense of privilege that says, oh, I don't really know who I'm going to vote for. When it comes to this election, the outcome of this election is going to affect the lives and even in many cases life or death for so many Americans living on the margin. The outcome of this election is going to determine whether people have health insurance or not. Donald Trump wants to throw out Obamacare, which immediately kids with diabetes who before were being denied health coverage because of pre-existing conditions. The outcome of this election is going to determine whether children who know no other country but ours, they were only a few months old, grew up in this country, whether they're deported vaccinations they don't know or even speak the language to. The outcome of this election is going to determine whether people living in poverty are going to have security and opportunity in this country.
This election season,
millions of Americans. And so if you're a Sanders supporter, don't vote for yourself. Vote for those people who are struggling for justice in America.
This election season has soured many would-be voters who are just disgusted with the rhetoric, the negativity, and candidly, both of the candidates. It may be easier to drift into apathy at this point and not even bother to vote. I've spoken to a handful of people who have said just that. How do you keep people believing in the process in these circumstances?
We are Americans, and we don't surrender to cynicism about our political system, and it is ours. Cynicism is a refuge for cowards. If you don't like what's going on, the answer is not to engage, it's to get disengaged. It's to engage more. Right now, what's happening to our political system is unacceptable. Your vote is your statement against it. Now, what has brought this into the gutter? I've watched many Republican primaries before, and they've all been about issues and ideas. Since I was a kid, watching Ronald Reagan debates in their primaries, what was the new factor in the primary that suddenly had Republican primaries talking about male genitalia? It was Donald Trump. I've watched now general election debates my entire career, my entire life as a kid, watching beautiful debates, talking about issues and ideas. What has been that brought this into the gutter? Talking about demeaning, degrading comments about women, it's Donald Trump. He has changed the national conversation. Not Jeb Bush, not Marco Rubio, not Chris Christie, not Hillary Clinton, not Bernie Sanders. It's been Donald Trump that has trashed our national conversation and our political debates. We need to reject that. And all of us, Republican and Democrats, need to make a statement about who we are as a country and what we stand for. We do not want in the White House where every single week we have the president of the United States saying something that we all are going to be embarrassed of. Every week in this election, whether it's Muslims, Latinos, women, whether it's saying punch people at rallies, every week we have seen something that Donald Trump that does not reflect the better angels of America. We cannot have that in the White House. We need to reject that. All Americans need to unite and say, you know what? This is not about right or left. This is about moving our country forward or back into the darker ages where this kind of thing was given far more license by the lesser folks, the demagogues of old.
New Jersey Democratic Senator Cory Booker is our guest here on WKAR's Current State. He is appearing at Michigan State University later this afternoon at a Get Out the Vote rally. Today is the voter registration deadline here in Michigan. You've got a mission, I guess, and that's to get people registered.
Yeah, it's absolutely, this is not a spectator sport. You can't sit on the sidelines and just cheer or hope for your team. You got to get on the field. You've got to be in the arena. You've got to be participating and engaging. It's a sad thing as I travel around the globe to see people in Afghanistan or India who, often risk their lives just going to vote, see that this democracy is one of the greatest gifts given to the planet Earth, and America has played a massive role in that. And for us not to participate, it's an insult to our ancestry, to the people that defend our rights and freedoms abroad. Please take responsibility, especially in this election, which is going to make a difference for everything from the presidency to the Supreme Court. Let your voice be heard.
We have just a couple of seconds, Senator Booker. You said back in July that you have no interest in running for governor of New Jersey once Chris Christie leaves office. Is that still the case?
That is still the case. I'm not running for governor. I love the Senate. I love Debbie Stabenow, Gary Peters. I want to work with them to get great things done.
Would you join a Clinton cabinet if she were successful?
I actually love Secretary Clinton. I talked to Tim Scott earlier this morning. I talked to Tim Kaine earlier this morning about partnering on an agenda to make change in America. I can serve this country best for the United States Senate. I know she's going to have, should she win, she's going to have a phenomenal cabinet, but I don't have any interest in being a part of that.
We've been talking about the Hillary Clinton ground game here in Michigan and the Democratic Party's Get Out the Vote effort and about this year's election. Cory Booker is the junior U.S. Senator from New Jersey. He's traveling through Michigan this week. He's in East Lansing this afternoon. The deadline to register for the election is today. Senator Booker, a pleasure talking with you.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
You are. Current state on 90.5 WKAR. Lansing's Happen Dance School has new leadership. Heather Vaughn Southard's first day in her new role was last week. She's been with the organization for a while in another capacity. In her career, she's performed as a dancer. She's been an educator, choreographer, and written about dance. To learn more about the school and about her plans for it, we welcome Heather Vaughn Southard.
Thank you.
Nice to meet you.
Likewise.
We incorrectly said that you were the new director of the Happen Dance a couple of times this past week. I want to be the last day or so, we want to be absolutely clear. You are the new leader of the Happen Dance School. That in mind, where exactly does the Happen Dance School fit under the larger umbrella of Happen Dance?
So we consider ourselves a dance service organization, and we've been around for 40 years. And this started with a professional company founded by Diane Newman and a collection of other women that we refer to as the Wise Women. And then the school was donated. It was originally directed by Diane Newman, and then she gifted that to the Happen Dance organization. And so the school itself is perhaps our largest function, but we also have a lot of other programming. So we, within the last 15 months, have opened a second location in Lansing, and that's the Happen Dance Exchange Lansing, which has come to fruition because of the work of Joan Nelson and the Allen Neighborhood Center. And then we also have programming such as Dance Lansing, which is a large dance festival that brings in community members of all different kinds and gives them a well-seasoned performance experience, even if they haven't necessarily had the technical and professional training up until that point. And then we also have launched Happen Dance Heels within the last 15 months, which is a large portion of what I've been doing, developing a relationship with healthcare so that patients from various locations, specifically Sparrow Hospital, come to us when they have a recreational prescription to continue services working in a physical capacity. And then, of course, we also have our K-12 outreach.
How interesting. Mm-hmm. The Sparrow piece,
yeah.
I mean. Is that sounds cutting edge. It sounds innovative.
It is. So in the field of dance, we have a lot of dance therapists that work in very direct and clinical medical situations. But we also have capacity for clinic to community services, and that's what Happen Dance is launching in this area. And so we're working within the scope of dance, and what we're able to do is, in this particular class, primarily geared towards adults, although we do offer children's services in this as well, is a syllabus that I've created called Creative Self-Care. And essentially I'm using Pilates therapy and somatic dance to address movement deficits. So, for example, if people have been experiencing physical therapy and either insurance has run out or they're technically their services are complete, but they don't necessarily feel that they are ready emotionally or physically to be functioning on their own, then they come to us.
Talk to us about how the Happen Dance School instructs dance students, though. Is there a particular approach that you take?
Well, we have a really academic model. So we look at the national standards of dance, and we address those and apply those into a community-based setting. So oftentimes, dance studios are working with the tradition of how those instructors have been taught themselves. And we're looking at not only the legacy that we've received as professional dancers, but also how do we address the whole child? And that's aligned with what happens in public school curriculum, but we address that in a community-type setting. In our Okemos location, we can do that vertically by offering very specific ballet, modern, jazz, tap, and other curriculum that's aligned vertically. And then in our Lansing location, we tend to slice that horizontally so that within a single dance class, then students are interacting with multiple forms of dance and styles. And then within all of those locations, we include creative process
You're pleased with that model, though? That model works in your view? I'm curious to know if you'd like to alter or enhance Happen Dance School's approach in any way now that you're in charge.
Absolutely. So I think we've got some work to do in terms of revising. The national standards went through an update within the last few years, and I want to make sure that our curriculum is aligned to the new national standards. And those involve perform, create, and respond. And so we'll be using some more formal assessments, not in a scary test type kind of way, but we just want to make sure that our students are really getting what we think that they're getting. But we also want to really expand our offerings in a way that we are really committed to community function. And that, I think, is what makes Happen Dance the place that I want to do my work. So we're very inclusive. We are addressing people that have various abilities and social and emotional needs, but we're also able to produce highly trained, college-ready professional and pre-professional dancers.
Very interesting. Heather Vaughn Southard just began her new role as the director of Lansing's Happen Dance School. She's our guest here on WKAR's Current State. I would take it that a lot of the students that you teach end up appearing in Happen Dance productions.
They do. So we have a recital each year, but we also have a summer dance festival, and then we have professional offerings as well. And so we're performing monthly, even for students that it's a nice alternative for families that may not be interested in the pressure and stress of competition dance, which has really distinct value in our industry, but not all families want to pursue that track for their students.
But it acclimates a student to performance, to being on stage.
Yep, it does. Really. And so the way that we approach that is that we have traditional and non-traditional performance venues, and they are guided through the creative process so that students are able to make their own dances, and they're also performing works by professional artists, those local and also regional and national names as well.
As the new director of the Happen Dance School, how are you inclined to measure success? How do you know when you're being effective in your role?
I think there's several different metrics that we're going to be looking at, one of which is what's happening in the classroom so that I'm able to assess what's happening from a growth mindset with students but also with our teachers. And I'm thinking about the number of community partners that are wanting to be involved in what we do so that we take very seriously our community identity. And in fact, the CEO, Misty Lilje, and I just presented on this at a national conference in Washington, D.C., explaining that we see dance primarily as a source of how do we improve quality of life and how many ways can we address those needs in our community. Sometimes that's by producing artists, but there's many other domains for that as well. And so the breadth and depth is what we're looking for.
I see Missy Lilje, who's appeared on this program, by the way, is running for the Lansing School Board.
She is.
Will she be holding on to her role at Happen Dance?
She will. And I think she'll do that very, very well and gracefully.
You mentioned the academic model, that is basically the touchstone here for your approach. Mm-hmm. Are there shortcomings to the academic model?
I think, you know, often there's where we miss people is that if they're looking for lots of sequins and the very super entertaining and that's going to be their immediate hook, that's where we lose people immediately. Mm-hmm. And we sort of have to educate our families to understand what we're going for. It's not just teaching kids to memorize movement, but to understand it from a functional perspective. And then how does that become actually a much better and more well-versed performer? And so helping people understand what that is one of our goals.
Let's talk about your background, because I was really struck with just how diverse and busy you have been. You've been involved in many aspects of dance. You've danced, you've taught, you've choreographed, you've written about dance. What are some of the highlights as you look back on your career, your working life so far? What are some of the highlights that really shaped your views about dance?
I think my training itself was very broad, but because I've been able to perform with many different types of experiences in Chicago and New York and Los Angeles, and then also move through various stratas of educational dance. So I've directed college dance programs, and I taught K-12 dance education as a specialist, so that really understanding the function of dance and the value of those intersections between the arts and other aspects of community and civic engagement have really shaped my goals as a social practitioner and wanting to make social change and make sure that everybody has the opportunity to understand themselves through movement.
Terrific conversation. I'm glad you could join us here today.
Thank you so much.
Heather Vaughn Southard just began her new role as director of Lansing's Happen Dance School. All the best to you.
Thank you.
I'm Mark Bayshore. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, NPR's Morning Edition includes the news feature Divided State this election season, presenting the differing views of voters on the 2016 presidential candidates. Now, Current State brings you voters from the greater Lansing area and how they're viewing this year's election. Listen in for Current State's hometown view of Divided State. Also, a couple of Michigan musicians will be appearing this Saturday night on NPR's A Prairie Home Companion. One has close ties to Lansing. Ahead of that, we'll talk tomorrow with bassist Dominic John Davis, formerly of Steppin' In It, who'll join Detroit native Jack White to perform Saturday night on A Prairie Home Companion with the new host, Chris Thiele. That and more tomorrow on Current State. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Kevin Lavery directed the show today. Thanks also to Scott Pohl, Katie Cook, Jamie Paisley, Brooke Allen, Drew Hill, and a very special thanks today to Isaac Constance. Don't forget the Current State podcast, available anywhere, anytime at iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Mark Bayshore. We hope you can join us Wednesday on Current State.